sunshine. Give me a do. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing Mountain Dew. So give me my good hands. Give me a do.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
In the shadow of a brand new Florida mall, where construction dust still hung in the air, a teenage boy cut through the tall grass on his mini bike and stumbled on something no child should ever see. What followed was a decades-long mystery, tangled up in the confessions of a supposed serial killer, shifting stories, and the quiet persistence of people who have refused to forget her. Nearly 50 years later, we still don't know her name. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
This week, we are joined by Kimberly Sue Murray.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, we have not been talking a lot about unidentified persons cases, which is part of our efforts.
It is. I know. Sometimes it's hard, though, because we don't have as much of, like, the nice things about... We don't have anything about their life, right?
Right.
Where on some of the other stories, at least, like, we're there to talk about a missing woman, but, like, a lot of the time you have, like, a really great story about them growing up or some other really fun information about them. That's nice to hear that they lived some sort of life before this.
Right. And it's, like, it's often hard. It's, like, how do you stay victim-centered when you don't have those details about the person?
Nothing about the victim.
Yeah. And it's also harder to research their cases because sometimes they go through by different names over time.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily are the newspapers going to use those, you know, what we call doe names for them. So yeah, we're going to try to make more of an effort.
Mm-hmm.
And so today we're talking about a Jane Doe case. November 24th, 1974. The top news story was the hijacking of a British plane in Tunisia. Murder on the Orient Express had just opened in theaters, and the song You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet was playing on every radio station. But just north of Orlando in Altamonte Springs, a 15-year-old boy wasn't thinking about any of that. He headed out on his mini bike for an afternoon adventure. It was just him and his bike whisking through the empty fields behind the Altamonte Mall, which had just opened only that summer. Though the mall was still under construction, that Sunday the construction vehicles sat silent. Behind the mall, it felt like a completely different world, a quiet, forgotten space tucked out of view. Heading down an unmarked road, he spotted something in the tall grass. What he discovered would launch a 50-year search for a woman's name, a story tangled in the confessions of a serial killer, the pursuit of truth, and the dedication of modern investigative genetic genealogists who are determined to bring her home.
You know, while you're telling me about this, like, you know how we often focus on the people that find the does when they're out?
Yeah.
And we're always saying that it's like, always, like, the good boys and girls, like the dogs. And
it's the
dog
dogs.
Walkers. And then a lot of the time it's also, like mushroom hunters or hunters, like, out in the woods. But we also have a lot of teenage boys who find bodies as well.
I think that's because we let boys adventure a little bit more, right?
So, like, it's less likely that, like, a boy in 1974 out on his own in this field behind a mall where no one can see him, he's at less risk.
Yeah, so, you know, we've coded, you know, girls as victims, boys as not, right? And so then a boy adventuring is safe, a girl adventuring is not. And so I think, yeah, we have a lot of boys who are out and about.
I mean, yeah, and sometimes things happen to boys too, but it's much, much more likely to be, like, if it's somebody targeting somebody, it's usually a woman.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of cases where victims are boys.
Right, but obviously. And there's been, like, serial killers that completely just, like, it's always boys.
But, right.
So, I mean, I'm not saying that it never happens to boys, but I think boys have more freedom, or we have it in our heads that they're safer.
I think we have in our heads that they're safer. So we just let them prowl around more than we let girls out adventuring, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in this case, yeah, another teenage boy who...
Yeah, because I think there's been like 3 or 4 now that we've talked about that it's been the teenage boys that...
Yeah, and I think...
Which is awful because it's a child finding
right
a body, but...
Yeah, we've had a few stories, and a few of them, you know, later on they've given interviews. This kid has not, to my knowledge, as a grown man now, but we've read other ones where, you know, the boy... As a grown-up, got to talk about kind of the impact that discovery had on their lives. So
I'm sure it's lifelong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that this is now his story is permanently connected to this person's story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so he finds something in the grass. And shortly after his discovery, the Seminole County Sheriff's Department kind of descends on this area, which is southeast of the mall. And the mall, it's located at the intersection of Interstate 4 and State Road 436. The site had been perfect for development. It's got easy access, booming growth, and proximity to Orlando. It still exists today. And actually on Threads, I've been having like this like long thread conversation with people about, there are people who like that was their mall.
Oh, really?
Growing up. Yeah.
And did they know any of this part of
well
it?
So I haven't shared this part okay of it, like that's their mall, right yeah,
huh.
But then, you know, it developed into this side conversation about everyone's like kind of favorite mall stores. But yeah, I mean, like this mall
is there a favorite one? I'm curious now,
is there a favorite one? So this was mostly you know, 1970s would have been different. So most of the people jumping in was the 1980s and 1990s. Mm-hmm. Mall rats like me. Mm-hmm. And Orange Julius was very popular.
Okay.
I have never been to an Orange Julius.
Okay.
But that came up quite frequently.
Yeah, I could see that being popular for a teenager too.
There were a bunch of people who were devotees of Walden Books, like my friends. Yes.
Me. Mm-hmm. I miss that store so much.
So much, yeah. And then, of course, Spencer's.
Yeah, I've never been a big Spencer's.
I was like, oh, you
know. It's fun. It's one of those stores you have to, like, run into as a teenager.
Right. That and really, like, you know, get the distinct Spencer's smell, like, locked in your, yeah, like, brain.
Like, the whole vibe of it. Mm-hmm. And just feel a little rebellious while you're in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was, like, a bunch of, like, Claire's.
There's this, yeah.
And then there was like a ton of stores that I'd never heard of before, but sounded really cool. And I probably would have walked around. Yeah. Music stores, I'm surprised they didn't come up quite as frequently. But yeah, for a lot of people, the Altamonte Mall was their mall.
Yeah.
And so it's like fascinating to like be thinking about like a case like this and then just also just like encountering people who like were in proximity to it. So yeah, I mean, I think
it's nice for you to do that, though, so you can, like, remind yourself that really good things can also coexist in a world where really bad things have happened, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah, because, like, I can get a little too, like...
I know, yeah.
About places and spaces and people. And,
right.
Yeah, and just so that was kind of nice. Like, and none of them mentioned this incident at all, so I didn't want to bring it up.
Well, right. I mean, they're all talking about their happy times getting, like... their orange drinks and their jewelry from Claire's and
and so like in 1974 it's like this mall is like just opening, like, you know, I remember when our mall was sparkly and brand new. But like, so this mall is under construction, right? Because like basically what they tried to do is they wanted to catch the holiday traffic, right?
Okay.
So they opened up before the mall was even done.
Okay, so it's still, like, being built, and they're opening up. So there's construction still happening all around
the
open mall. Okay.
So based on what I could tell from kind of the chatter from, like, various threads, because there's just, like, so many.
Okay, and we're close to the holidays, too, right?
So yes.
They probably want that.
They wanted the mall traffic. So it opened up, like, in August to try to capture that. And from my understanding, based on, like, I don't know, there are like mall Reddit threads. There's like all kinds. People love their malls. And my understanding is this was not completed until like December. So like November, they're still under construction, right? Okay. Things are still happening.
And that's when our boy is out there finding.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is kind of behind the mall, which is like, you know, a world unto itself, right? So that's where like the grass is growing up. It's 4 feet high. And the deputies are out there after this call comes in. They're having to push aside this really tall grass. They're making their way down a slight embankment to what the boy had found. And there in the tall grass lying face up were the decomposed remains of a woman. Now, later that day, the sheriff's department actually told reporters that they believed that the woman had been sexually assaulted, but they wouldn't reveal why initially. Only later would they say that it was because her blue knit pants had been pulled down and her top was pulled up around her neck. Because of the nature of this discovery, the Seminole County medical examiner, who was Dr. G.V. Garay, he was called to the scene. And surveying the body, he estimated that she had been there for 1 to 2 weeks. Because of the level of decomposition, it was impossible initially to determine the cause of death just from a cursory examination alone. She did have that clothing with her, but she didn't have any identification. So in that moment, investigators understood they'd be working in two directions. Who was she and what happened to her? On Monday, which is the next day, deputies from Seminole County and officers from Altamonte Springs, they combed the area where her body had been found. At first, when the call had come in, there had been confusion about the jurisdiction, like who is in charge of this case, right? The mall kind of straddled some boundary lines. So Seminole County initially took the lead until things could be sorted out. By Monday afternoon, though, officials had confirmed that she was found roughly 100 feet inside the Altamonte Springs city limits. Sheriff John Polk, though, assured the public that the case would be handled as a joint effort between them both.
Which I think is good, because otherwise it feels like things would get lost from the turning over, right? Like,
right. We do see that happen sometimes. And on the other hand, sometimes when it's like divided between jurisdictions, it's like who gets the lead, who's in charge, who like is doing the questioning, all of that.
There's like no winning in this situation.
Yeah. Like there are pros and cons, I think, of both approaches. So sifting through the grass, both by hand and with metal detectors, investigators found a few clues, which was just an engagement ring and a wedding band. The bands held no inscription, but they did contain a maker's mark. And it wasn't much, but at least it was something. On Tuesday, Dr. Gray was joined by Dr. Thomas Heger, the Orange County medical examiner, and the two of them worked together to kind of see if they could identify the woman and determine her cause of death.
It's funny because, like, with the wedding rings, you would almost guess, like, just think that somebody would have reported their wife missing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so often that...
That's not the case.
That's not the case.
Yeah, so, like, what's the story there?
Right.
Now, their initial assessment of this woman is that she's somewhere between the ages of 35 and 45 years old and likely white. The autopsy did reveal 2 stab wounds, 1 to the chest and 1 to the abdomen. Beyond that, though, they really had little to go on. Altamonte Springs had previously worked with the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. on a case that involved the discovery of 2 young women at a dump the previous August. One of them had been successfully identified as Laura Lynn Harberts. And with that partnership in mind, the medical examiners hoped the Smithsonian could actually help out in this case as well.
Okay, so they identified Laura, but you said there were 2 of them. Mm-hmm. 2 people? Yeah. Were they together?
They were in the same dump, like placed on top of one another.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
But were the women associated with each other in any way, or we don't know?
I don't know yet. I initially thought, as I was starting to kind of get into this case, I initially was going to start researching the unidentified Jane Doe from 1973. Okay. And then I ended up in this case.
Okay. So you were going after the person found with Laura, not Seminole County Jane Doe at all.
Yes.
So this is... The story got hijacked.
The story got hijacked. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
are we going to return to her?
We absolutely will. So she's on my list. So, you know, they're like, could they be connected? They had a conversation about that, obviously, from the start. They are not.
Okay.
But yeah, we'll be covering the 1973 Jane Doe in the future.
Okay.
But I had to, like, double check every time to make sure I was talking about the 1974 Jane Doe.
Are they both under the same name?
No. Okay. So, the basically, when you're like, unidentified body, Altamonte Springs, like, both will come up.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the other young woman who's young, she is often, her Jane Doe name is often given as Ginger. So, that helped kind of.
And we'll be covering Ginger.
Yes.
Jane Doe in the future. Okay. Yeah. But again, this goes back to that conversation at the beginning. These are all women mm-hmm. that are found. So this just kind of reinforces in our mind that those boys are safe being out of our sight because like, but our girls aren't, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, I think these kind of beliefs that we have then just get reaffirmed by cases like this. Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, both of these cases end up being the 1973 Jane Doe and the 1974 Jane Doe actually end up being connected to like really horrible people. So we'll get into that.
We'll get there. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so they're hoping like the Smithsonian will come through basically. Now it takes until mid-December for them to hear back, which is actually not all that long considering she's found at the end of November. And at the Smithsonian, her remains were assessed by Dr. Lawrence Angel, who had actually at that point spent 12 years assisting law enforcement across the country and had worked on more than 300 unidentified cases.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
In 12 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yikes.
And that's just the ones that the Smithsonian had been contacted to, like, assist with. Dr. Angel, he concluded that this woman, who they're now calling Seminole County Jane Doe, stood between 5 foot and 5 foot three. She had reddish or light brown hair. He noted that she appeared stocky based on what he called her medium bone structure. And that seemed consistent with the clothing found at the scene. Her pants had a 38-inch waist. Examining her bones, Dr. Angel found evidence of arthritis in her feet and her knees. He felt the presence of arthritis could have been exacerbated by weight, or it might have been suggestive of a physically demanding occupation. Now, an examination of her teeth actually backs this up. Seminole County Jane Doe had numerous cavities and fillings, but it was a distinctive wear pattern that caught Dr. Angel's attention. After examining thousands of remains through his work, he said the pattern was common among people working in the sewing trades, like those who kind of pulled thread through their teeth while they were sewing or spinning.
So is it like little grooves
mm-hmm.
in your teeth from the thread always yeah. catching the same spot?
Yeah.
It makes sense, but it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So like if you're in that occupation, you're doing that a lot. That's
I also like how you clarified after examining thousands of remains through his work.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And Dr. Angel's safe. Okay.
Yes.
Pretty sure. Now, since then, others have speculated that the similar wear is sometimes seen in cosmetology or hairstyling professions.
Hmm.
So you're like kind of
like where you need an extra hand always. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always like, do oh. that. Like if I'm trimming like my son's hair,
mm-hmm.
like hold the comb in my teeth for a few minutes while mm-hmm. I'm trying to get my self all arranged with the scissors because I don't want to cut myself.
Right. I mean, it does make me think, like, what are the stories, like, my teeth would tell about, like, my habits and growing up. And,
right.
Yeah.
It's really weird, isn't mm-hmm. it? Huh.
So knowing this wear pattern could help narrow some potential backgrounds or lifestyles or skill sets that she might have had before her death. So mm-hmm. this is hopefully a clue. They're hoping this is a clue. Additional information released later suggested that she had been pregnant at least twice, which means that Seminole County Jane Doe may have children out there, people who grew up wondering what happened to their mother. While this information helped paint a portrait of who she might have been, none of it led to a positive identification. Those details did not match any local missing persons reports, so it left investigators at a standstill. The best tangible evidence they had were those rings, manufactured by a company called Swirsky. And no, I'm not saying Swarovski wrong. Swirsky.
Swirsky. Okay.
In Los Angeles, only 18 of those ring sets had ever been made, and they were sold exclusively in California and Arizona.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you'd think they'd be only able to,
18? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd think you could find something based on that alone, but yeah. How, right? How would you?
They're really an interesting set, and they're kind of like fused together, the two rings.
Okay.
To investigators, like, those details created a patchwork of promising clues, but for decades, none would actually lead to her name. None lead to the identification of Seminole County Jane Doe. Despite additional interviews and information, the Seminole County Sheriff's Office didn't feel any closer to identifying her. So as months turned into years, neither question in her case, what happened to her or who she was, seemed any closer to resolution. Then in 1982, the biggest break in the case arrived. A man named Gerald Staino, who we recently decided we're going to say names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're trying this out, guys. So let us know, I guess, how you feel about it. I started thinking that maybe we're letting people off the hook too easily by not mentioning what they've done. Mm-hmm. I think Amy's feeling that, like, maybe that is something too. Like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, we still want you to know, obviously, more or carry with you or remember the parts about the women, but we are going to start mentioning, naming names, pointing fingers.
Yes.
Yes.
So we're going to see how I feel. Okay.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of gross.
Yeah, it is so gross.
Yeah. I know how you feel about it. Yeah. So yeah, we're going out on a limb here.
Okay. So this man, his name's Gerald Staino, which might not be in many people's kind of dictionary of killers, but we're getting there now.
Okay.
He confessed to murdering her, but the confession actually does little to resolve anything, which we're going to get into.
Hmm. Okay.
Okay. To understand why that might be, we actually have to get into a little bit of who Gerald Staino was. He was born in 1951 in Schenectady, New York. And he spent the first few months of his life severely neglected and was eventually placed in foster care with the intent for him to be adopted. This was not a straightforward process because even as a toddler, Staino exhibited difficult and disturbing behaviors.
How is that possible for a toddler?
So what we're talking about is at this point, he's about kind of 6 months old. He doesn't get adopted fully until he's two. So they're kind of...
Right, but what can a six-month-old do that can't be, like, corrected or... I don't know.
Okay, so some of the stuff that I read that he was doing at that age is potentially eating his own fecal matter.
But is that just a thing of negligence?
Like, I think it is a thing of negligence. But I think what they're worried about is, like, could...
Would that do damage?
Well, okay, so
I don't know.
To be clear, this does not stop, like, behaviors like that don't stop his adoptive parents, Norma and Eugene Staino, from wanting to adopt him.
Okay.
But before he could be adopted, he was actually assessed by psychologists, social workers, and doctors. And so I think it goes beyond, like, the fecal matter eating.
Okay.
Or playing with his own fecal matter. I think there's some probably other things that were like alarm bells for them. And they determined that he was unadoptable.
Hmm. I'm so interested in that now. Not because of like, I'm not trying to like think of why he was the way he was. Mm-hmm. But like just if anyone now would be like just considering that baby like, oh, that baby's unadoptable.
Mm.
Or if we would be trying to find a way to help that baby be adoptable.
Right. I mean, I think... Because
the 70s to now?
Well, yeah. So, like, you know, my parents adopted...
Oh, wait, no. Was it... It wouldn't be the 70s. This case is from the 70s. So, the 50s to now.
Yeah. My parents adopted kids in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, like, back then, it was kind of like, you adopted the kid and there's, like, no support services after that. Like,
okay.
Yeah. So... No, I don't know. So is it unadoptable because, like, essentially these parents are unprepared to, like, take care or address any behaviors? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope we're doing better, I guess, with the class. Like, obviously, this guy that we're about to talk about has problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's making my argument seem pointless. But I hope that at this given time, we're not just like, oh, that child is, like, doomed. Don't pick that one.
Right.
I hope we're doing better.
We'll be back in a moment.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So, you know, all of these assessments, despite this assessment from all these professionals, the Stainos are like, no, we're going for it. I think largely because, like, this kid came from a highly abusive situation of neglect.
Right? So they're in, like, my train of thought of, like, oh, we can fix that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I don't blame them, right?
Like, right.
They wanted to help this kid. So right. They adopt him. That adoption goes through around the age of 2. From that point forward, though, he's kind of just often in trouble. Like, we're talking behaviors that range from sort of just general boundary testing, like talking back, being disruptive, etc., to outright like criminal acts, like throwing rocks off of highway overpasses kind of thing.
People get injured?
I'm not sure.
Yikes. Okay.
So they're trying what they can. And again, like, resources are probably pretty limited, you know, based on my experience. They were in the, like, 70s and 80s. Not even, like, going to military school sets them straight. Because that used to be the thing, like, set them straight, mm-hmm. right? Send them to military school.
Scared straight. Was yeah. Like that, yeah.
So, eventually, you know, things are just not getting much better with him. The family moves from New York to Pennsylvania. And after graduating from high school, which he doesn't do until he's 21, he actually moves out on his own and goes to New Jersey. And he struggled there as well. He developed issues with drinking and drugs until his parents basically insist he move with them to Florida because they were heading there to help care for his grandmother. So while he's in Florida, Staino actually has trouble maintaining steady work, but he does actually marry a woman named Michelina in 1975. This marriage is pretty short-lived. After 6 months and multiple incidents of abuse, it ended, and he ends up moving back in with his parents. Then we kind of fast forward to 1980. In March 1980, a woman walked into a police station in Daytona Beach, Florida, and reported an attack. She said that she had been offering sexual services on Atlantic Avenue when a man pulled up and they agreed on a price. In her hotel room, he refused to pay her up front and the two started arguing and then he slashed her with a knife.
Did she go straight to the police station, not the hospital?
She goes to the hospital.
Okay, like, and then over to the police station?
Yeah, so this is a pretty deep wound. It's like a cut across her thigh. It required 30 stitches. Like,
why would I be just under the impression that the police would meet her at the hospital?
Well, because
would she... Would that happen now?
Well, but you would have to call the police or the hospital would have to call in the police in a situation like that.
I feel like the hospital would.
In this case, they did not.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
So it's often difficult for sex workers to report crimes like this, but she actually makes her way into report and she reports to Detective Jim Gadbury and insisted that she could identify her attacker. She also knew where his car was parked because she had seen it. By the time they arrived, though, this car is gone. Later, though, Gadbury spotted one matching her description. It's a very distinct red car, and he records the license plate number. Running the plate number led him to Staino, who was already connected to a series of assaults on other sex workers. Nothing he's been convicted of, to be clear. Gadbury later said that thinking about the slash on the victim's thigh reminded him of another unsolved case. And this was the murder of 20-year-old Mary Carol Mayer. Mary had left the Holiday Inn boardwalk on North Atlantic Avenue earlier that year, and she had never returned. Nearly 3 weeks later, her body was found. She'd been stabbed multiple times in the chest and back. But what caught Gadbury's attention were the slash wounds to Mary's thighs and chest. Now, there's a lot of pressure to solve Mary's case. So when this kind of similarity comes about, Gadbury goes immediately and he talks to Police Chief Paul Crow. And that's also enough for Paul Crow. He's like, let's question this guy. So when Staino is brought in for questioning about the attack on the sex worker, he's also questioned about Mary Carol Mayer's murder. Chief Crow would later claim that Staino's body language was easy to read during questioning, that he would lean forward when he was telling the truth and he would lean backwards when lying. He's like his own, like, lie detector. During questioning, Sino first said he picked Mary up and then dropped her off. So he said, yeah, I did encounter her. Freely admitted that. But then, as the interview continued, he eventually confessed, I stabbed her several times in the chest. And then he described the murder in more detail.
Okay. And is that what happened to Mary?
Yeah. So, you know, they were like, this is the guy. We've got the guy. Right. So before the paperwork can even be completed, like for Mary Carol Mayer's murder, detectives kind of are lining up to see if Staino could be connected to other cold cases. Like, this is a guy that they're interested in. If he could have killed her, if he slashed the sex worker, who else could he have harmed? Now, before he's done, Staino will have confessed to 41 murders, though Chief Crow would later claim the number could be upwards of 80.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're all in this area?
No. The crimes that he ends up confessing to or considered for, these span from 1969 to his arrest in 1980. And they took place primarily in Florida, but also in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, like where he had lived.
Okay.
And one of those confessions would be connected to Seminole County Jane Doe. So he comes in 1980, but he doesn't confess to murdering her until 1982. On October 29th, during a three-hour interview with Altamonte Springs Police Detective Cliff Chellew, Staino said that in 1974, he picked up a hitchhiker near Altamonte Springs. He said she was walking along Interstate 4 when he gave her a ride. He propositioned her, and when she rejected him, he became angry. Detectives later noted this matched his past behaviors that he had talked about in other crimes. His anger often escalated when he was rejected. Staino then said he stabbed her and then left her body in an overgrown field. So though Staino's confession seemed to answer the what happened question, it did little to help investigators determine who she might have been. He didn't know anything about her. He would later go on to confess to 16 more murders. That year, Staino was convicted of the murders of Mary Carol Maher, Nancy Hurd, and Tony Van Haddix. By the next year, 1983, he waived his right to a trial and pleaded guilty to killing Susan Bickrest and Mary Kathleen Muldoon. He was also convicted of the murder of 17-year-old Kathy Lee Scharf, who had been hitchhiking near Port Orange, Florida when she disappeared. Her body was found in January 1974. In 1998, at the age of 46, Staino was executed via electric chair. His last words were, I am innocent. Now I am dead and you do not have the truth.
That's a pretty wild statement from somebody who confessed to a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
So what does that even, do we know what that means?
Well, he has become a complicated figure. Because he confessed to so many crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, basically after these, like this flurry of confessions, basically many questioned, like, are those admissions valid? Can we trust them? Like some believed that he was a serial confessor, similar to like Henry Lee Lucas, basically someone who committed some murders, but falsely confessed to a lot more.
So did they do any murders? Did they do some but wanted to look like they did more, or did they not do any at all and wanted to pretend they did?
Well, yeah, for serial confessors, it can be any number of things.
But for this guy, do we think he did do some of the things?
Yeah, well, I think that's complicated. There are people who side with he did nothing.
Ooh.
There are people who side with he killed 80.
So we don't know.
There are people who side with he probably is guilty of some of them and just serial confessed to more.
Okay.
And those
we know he did do bad things, though, because he was the one who, like, slashed the woman's thigh.
Yeah. I'm going with he likely committed some crimes and then serial confessed to
some like more. Expanded what he.
Right.
But now because he is dead, we won't know the truth. And that's what he was, like, taunting them with, right?
Mm-hmm. And the reasons for serial confession, this is, it's very complicated.
It can happen for a lot of reasons, because, like, on the confessor's side, you've got, like, interrogation pressure, right? There's also, like, this bizarre, this, like, opportunity to interact with law enforcement. So, like, if you're in prison and you're dealing with, like, kind of the monotony of prison, you get out every once in a while, you get, like, talk to some guys for a few hours.
It's like a break?
It's like a break, okay. Yeah. There's also the notoriety of kind of having a, this is disgusting, high body count.
Oh, that is disgusting, you mean? Yeah.
On law enforcement side, there's also reasons that this ends up happening. Like, there's a need to, like, kind of clear the books. So if you've got cases that are lingering, unsolved, right?
Okay.
So, like, in this case, like, before they even have, like, the Mary Carroll thing even written up, like, people are lining up. Like, I've got this cold case. I've got this cold case.
So, like, some convenience on the work.
Yeah.
Work efforts or, like, the, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, if you are getting a lot of heat because your division or what have you has just not been clearing your cases, there's a reason, right? There's also, you know, the appeal of kind of capturing someone who's infamous, right? Like, taking part and taking down someone like that, right? So that's where the facts around his case grow murky. Daytona Beach officer James Gadbury, who you'll remember as the officer who was assigned to the 1980 attack on the sex worker, he later claimed that he witnessed Chief Crow feeding details about the murder to Staino.
Okay.
Essentially kind of filling in blanks and with leading questions.
And he's the one who kind of, like, had that whole theory of, like, leaning forward, leaning back. Okay.
And in 1996, Crow was actually removed from his position due to corruption in an unrelated case. So he's a complicated figure in his own right. Also, in 2007, there was this FBI report which criticized the lack of laboratory work or the poor quality of it in cases connected to executions in Florida. Basically, that, like, the work was not done or not done well before people were executed in Florida. And that included Gerald Staino. Investigators said that they found no positive associations linking Staino to the crime for which he was convicted and executed.
So some people could have been executed for no reason?
I mean, I think that's what the FBI is saying.
Okay.
Right. And so Staino, to be clear, by the time he's executed, actually had several execution orders placed on him.
Okay.
Because he had been convicted of several execution worthy or execution designated cases. And one of those was he was actually technically executed for the murder of Kathy Lee Scharf, the 17-year-old. So basically, the FBI is saying, like, we don't think that there was enough there. On the other hand, there are other people like, well, like, even if that one was vacated, he also had execution orders for a number of other murders.
So at some point, that would have been the end result anyway.
I think that's, you know, essentially the argument here.
Okay.
So Staino does, though, to be clear, he remains the primary suspect in the murder of Seminole County Jane Doe. They do, from my understanding, believe he confessed correctly and that he did murder her.
Okay.
So one of the things that I struggle about when we talk about serial killers, or even, I guess in this case, serial confessors, maybe also serial killer, is how easily their victims just become like a long faceless list of names. Like, we forget who these women and girls were, the lives that they should have lived, right?
Right.
So take 12-year-old Susan Bazile. She was in 1978. She got off her school bus in Port Orange and she started walking home and she never made it. And Staino ends up claiming that he got her into his car by saying that he would take her to the Starlight Skate Center, and he described where he left her body. But she was never found there, and his statements don't align with eyewitness accounts because people reported seeing two men in a van abduct her.
So that might have been one of the...
Yeah, like, is that true? Yeah. Is it not? Huh. Was the eyewitness right? Was the eyewitness not?
Right. And then did he do this on his, did he confess to it on his own, or was he kind of like led into it? There's a lot of questions now. Yeah.
Yeah. Or consider 13-year-old Gail Joyner, whose story I've actually thought about for years, stretching all the way back to writing my poetry collection, Doe. We have not covered her yet in our podcast, but Gail went missing in Florida. She was never found. And Staino is actually one of three separate individuals who have claimed responsibility for her murder.
All three confessed to this one girl's murder.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it pretty impossible, doesn't it?
It's
completely solve.
Is it one of you? Is it none of you?
Right.
Yeah. But at the end, though, like, these were real girls, real women, and their stories deserve to be heard and not just reduced to a statistics in someone's kind of grim tally.
Right.
Thankfully, though, there are efforts to solve these cases, and they didn't end with his confession or even with his 1998 execution. Of the women he claims to have killed, two remained unidentified for many years, and one of them is Seminole County Jane Doe. The other was a woman found on November 5th, 1980, in a wooded median on Interstate 95 near the Volusia and Brevard County line. I probably butchered that one. Floridians.
Yeah.
Researchers at Estrella Forensics were able to extract DNA from that Jane Doe. And in 2024, she was identified through investigative genetic genealogy as Pamela K. Whitman. Pamela was 25 when she went missing from Indiana. As Sheriff Mike Chitwood said after the identification, this brings closure to a family that has spent decades wondering what happened to their loved one. While the truth is heartbreaking, I'm grateful for the hard work that allowed us to give Pamela the dignity she deserves in a proper memorial. And today there's a plaque where her body was found, and it bears her name and her photograph, and beneath it are the words, "She had the voice of an angel." And I think Seminole County Jane Doe's family kind of deserves that same dignity. Thankfully, the team at Ramapo College is actually actively working on her case right now.
That's amazing.
Now, the college has an investigative genetic genealogy certificate program. They take on unidentified decedent cases in the hopes of restoring their names and giving their families long-awaited answers. Based on a recent news report, the pathway to identifying Seminole County Jane Doe might not be simple.
How come?
So sometimes it's data and information. So as a reminder for how this works, investigative genetic genealogists start with DNA from an unidentified person and build family trees using their DNA matches, similar to the cousin matches that you see if you've ever taken a 23andMe or Ancestry DNA test. However, like, genealogists can't use those commercial databases like 23andMe or Ancestry DNA directly. Instead, they have to rely on platforms where users voluntarily upload their raw DNA, such as FamilyTree DNA or GEDmatch. The current findings, or the information that they released, is that Seminole County Jane Doe's ancestry, they've gotten it back as far as 1727, with branches reaching into North Carolina and Ohio, and early indicators suggest Irish and Italian descent. So if that sounds like your ancestry, you can help.
So how can we help?
Okay. So if you have taken an Ancestry DNA or 23andMe test, so if you've already taken one,
yeah,
you are allowed to, I give you permission, but you can go in to your account and you can actually download your data from there. There's an option to do that. And then you can upload it to FamilyTree DNA or GEDmatch. When you do so, you'll actually be asked whether or not you consent to law enforcement access, which sounds like a scary thing. But if your goal is to assist in cases like this, you would just select yes, that law enforcement can use it, because that's, though Ramapo College is doing the investigative genetic genealogy side of it, it's for law enforcement use.
Okay.
So I just feel like we are so close, after nearly half a century, to giving Seminole County Jane Doe her name back. Let's help make sure that happens.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, What Holds Us, read by Kimberly Sue Murray. Kimberly Sue Murray is a Canadian actor best known for her recurring roles in Shadowhunters, V-Wars, and The Boys. She won Best Lead Performance at HIFF 2022 and earned an Actor Award nomination for her gripping turn in XYZ Films' Traitor. Recent credits include Die Alone, The Madness, Titans, and Transplant. Murray portrays Gamora in Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy video game by Eidos Montréal, which won Best Ensemble Cast Performance at the Gang Awards.
What holds us? Unidentified woman discovered November 24th, 1974, in Altamont, Florida. All of the houses are haunted. Ghosts knee-deep in the dark corners of memory. At the edges of highways, ghosts glisten in the sawgrass. Tendrilled fog wafting off the marshes like a call. What holds us to this earth? The damp ground, the salted sand, the glimmer of golden rings shining in the light of morning are tethers. On the highway, a woman turns her finger to the wind, hails down a devil in a red car, and hopes her body arrives unscathed. What is it like here? A body laid down in the dirt, hidden by grass. People so close to seeing her passing by the scene. Here, this is a haunting. The way we pull her from the weeds, hold her body in our hands, wrest her name from the silence.
For more information about our show, please visit shegoesbyjanepodcast.com.
Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.